Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, Game Wisdom's owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Ohm.
Hey there.
And our returning guest from Arkane Games, lead designer and owner, Chris Park.
Hey, good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. So, about a week or so ago, you released Skyward Collapse, and this is looking to be a really interesting game. It's been getting some great reviews.
Yeah, it's been really positive so far. The one of our better launches, actually. So that's really a relief after Shattered Haven did so poorly. I know you loved that one.
Yeah.
All of my games I love, but we're always proud of all the ones we put out. But the market did not care for Shattered Haven as a whole, although we have a number of fans who really love it, but, you know.
Yeah, c'est la vie.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was reading on your forum that so far, Skyward is your second best launch, I think, outside of A Valley Without Wind.
Right. The first Valley Without Wind did just, yeah, that was nuts. I mean, that one, you know, we made, like six figures in the first month and then, you know, half that again in the second month. So, I mean, that one was like three times better than than any other launch we've ever had. And this one is kind of middle of the road between, our third best launch and our second best. So it's good. If you consider, you know, units sold, given this is a third the price of, what Valley 1 was, this is far and away our best launch ever in terms of units sold. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And one thing that we've been noticing is Arkane's been releasing a lot more games in quicker time frames. And I know in our email you were talking about how Arkane's been changing their development structure around. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Some of what's happened already in terms of the past, you know, we've put out a number of things this year, really doesn't reflect that. Skyward is the first one that does. Valley 2 and Shattered Haven, those happened to come out in real quick succession because we'd been working on those simultaneously. And those both had, you know, longer development stretches, six-ish months for Valley 2. But again, that was building on, you know, the engine from Valley 1 and, you know, a bunch of knowledge from that. So that was still a pretty time-consuming project, and it was a direct sequel. So that was something that kind of helped keep that shorter. So that one doesn't really count, in other words. And then Shattered Haven, rather, also doesn't really count because, that took lots of time over 4 years and was, again, more of our traditional development process. Those just happened to release, you know, boom, boom, you know, month after each other. And then, you know, we've got an AI War expansion that comes out, in a couple of weeks, actually. And that one also really, in terms of our new process, doesn't fully count because we've been doing that for a long time with AI War expansions, you know, because we have a mix of free content and then an expansion every, at least one a year. And, that's been something where because we're coding into an existing engine and game design space and so forth, we're able to just take some beefy new ideas, some what we call like a new anchor feature essentially, and then some other smaller pieces of content to go in as well. So you've got kind of one or two main anchor features and then a bunch of kind of pebbles around it that add more variety, but that aren't singularly exciting by themselves. And, so we take that sort of thing and then we spend, you know, a month or three, depending on how many developers we have on it, you know, developing it out and then kind of going through beta testing and so forth. And so that's been a long running process for us. The new thing that we're doing with starting with Skyward is a process for how we're developing new games. We're kind of, one of the reasons we're able to do this is that we're leveraging all of the assets and the engine development and so forth that we've been doing over the last 4 years in general. So, you know, we don't have to do so much engine development while we're also doing game development, which is another reason why, for instance, like the AI War expansions are quicker to do is because we don't have to do engine development while we're doing them. And, you know, at least 40%, if not more, of our time with like Valley One, for instance, which was this massive 18-month project for, you know, five people. So it's like 10 man years practically. That was, a lot of that was spent on engine development, and that just really sucks up the time. But at this point, we're kind of reaping the benefits of that. So there's a lot less time that has to go into engine development and more time that can be focused on just the gameplay. Now, in terms of our shift in mentality, though, since we have this ability to just focus on the gameplay, what we decided to do was to focus on making a smaller sort of game that has, you know, a dozen or two or three hours worth of gameplay in it rather than shooting for 100 plus. I mean, you know, with AI War, we've got people that have 600 plus hours on their Steam profile. And, you know, Valley One, there's a lot of people that have well over 100 hours or 200 hours. So, you know, and that's all off of the base game in terms of Valley One. But, I mean, that's a risky thing for us to do because you never know if you're going to break even on something like that. It just depends on how the market reacts to it, if it's the right game at the right time and if enough people like it. And going along with that, you also have the problem of it's more expensive for the customer. So if it's a $15 game because it's been this, you know, really long development process and it's expensive and, you know, so on. We spent just originally making Valley One north of $300,000 making it. And then, you know, between Valley One and Two, that's been north of $500,000 all told in order to make those. Mm-hmm. And it takes a while before you can make that up. So even with a massively successful game, you know, is it going to be that successful? It's hard to say. So for instance, with Skyward, and the other games that we're working on these days is that we are focusing on trying to make a core experience that is fun and small and accessible and something that we can reasonably sell for about $5. And that way it's something that is a lot less risky for a player to get into as well. They can pick that up on an impulse and go, hey, this looks like fun. Let me try it out. And if it is fun, you know, they get, you know, if it's sort of fun and they get, you know, a few hours out of it or whatever, that's still a pretty good value compared to most forms of entertainment. So they haven't lost much. So it's a low risk to them. And if they're really into it, then, I mean, it's a great value. And then if something kind of peters out and it's just like, well, you know, that was a fun $5 experiment or whatever, then, you know, we've lost relatively little. We've made somebody happy. I mean, there's always somebody that likes everything that we do. And so that's always a good feeling. And, you know, that can just be let to rest. But then if it's something that actually takes off better, then we can, focus on extending that and get to the 100 plus, you know, hours of gameplay mark by doing the same sort of mixture we've done with AI War for since 2010, really, well, 2009, of doing a mixture of free content and paid expansions. And so, you know, for instance, to get to the original cost of AI War, which was $20 at launch, we would have to do five expansions for Skyward Collapse to take those five expansions plus the base game of Skyward Collapse to equal just the original game of AI War in terms of cost to the consumer. Yeah. And so that's something that makes for a really easy value proposition, I think, for the players. I mean, it's such a win for the customer. And then for us, too, you know, that lets us focus on the things that people are actually responding well to and liking. And, you know, AI War originally it had around maybe 100 hours worth of content, but the only reason that people are putting in like 600 plus hours is because of all the expansions that it's seen and the continual development that it's seen over a 4-year span. I mean, it's such a better game now than when it was in 2009. And I mean, it was the 40th best reviewed game on Metacritic and, you know, like maybe 6th or something out of indie games, because it has like the AAAs in there as well, in 2009. So, yet, you know, being able to have it build up over time makes it just increasingly solid. So that's kind of the idea with Skyward and with our other games that are coming up, is that we want to focus on a kernel, make sure that that's good and, you know, a great value and a good game for just that, and if that's all it ever is, then okay. But if it's something that people really like, then let's keep going, sort of thing.
And that definitely sounds like a smart business strategy, especially in today's market. I mean, we're seeing a lot of issues with, like, AAA developers who are, you know, spending millions of dollars on their games and are not sure if they're ever going to recoup that back. And you never really do know whether your next game's going to be that colossal hit or it's going to be, you know, one and done in a month and then no one will ever talk about it again.
Right. Right.
It's one of those things that, it's tricky though for a AAA developer to really take. I mean, I would say that in some respects, Nintendo might be the closest to taking this. Now, I mean, they QA the heck out of their games, so that's a little bit different, because, you know, they release it and never update it. But, you know, they have, you can see clearly that they have engines that they use. They've got, you know, the Zelda 3D engine. They've got the Zelda, like, they have the Zelda Game Boy Color and Game Boy engine. They have, like, you know, the Mario, the new Super Mario Brothers engine that they use and so forth and so on. And they keep reusing those in games, but upgrading the graphics some. But it's still in terms of, you know, 3D games, they're relatively, I don't want to say lo-fi because they're really pretty, but they're not pushing the technical boundaries, let's put it that way.
Well, they're playing it really safe.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're all about focusing on the design. You know, I buy the latest Mario game because I want to play the levels and see what cleverness they thought up with the suits or whatever other abilities and enemies and so on. And so, you know, they're clearly design and experience focused there. And I think that, you know, they don't really say that I've ever seen what their internal development costs are on those sort of things, but I'm positive it's nowhere near like the latest Call of Duty or something, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, I mean, they're able to kind of do that sort of thing. And some of the indies that do kind of very artsy games that are still a little bit abstract in some way. I mean, even like Limbo or something, I mean, it's beautiful. And it, you know, it has so much care put into it, but it's also kind of a discrete experience in terms of how long it is. And it's got, an art aesthetic that is really attractive, but at the same time, simpler than it could have been in a lot of respects, you know, with just the silhouettes and everything. So, you know, and for us, we pursue something that's more abstract. I mean, you know, like Darwinia or something, that was a very abstract game, but it's very, very fun. And so we focus on the gameplay and, you know, enough graphics to make it clear what's going on. But Skyward Collapse, for instance, is a little bit board game-like. And with our next game, we're going to be going kind of, possibly kind of vector inspired, but, you know, I mean, like Prison Architect or something. There's another one where it's kind of icon based. You know, you can tell what's going on. It's fun. And that's, let's get going. It's all about the design there, you know, FTL, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of where that's kind of our wheelhouse, I think. And so it allows us to do that sort of thing. And I think others are doing it with like the alpha funding model, you know, where they're not kind of spending a bunch of money and then praying that it works out. But then you have all these customers that had like a different idea of what the game might be and that, you know, are expecting, you know, miracles from the Kickstarter. There's a lot of baggage that comes with a successful Kickstarter, as has been kind of publicly established at this point. And so, you know, avoiding that if possible is a good thing, I think. So, you know, we're self-funding and then, you know, here is the actual game. If you like this, buy it. If you don't, that's fine. Thank you. You know, and so that way we get kind of the funding from the sale of the base game to continue developing out more stuff if people want. So,
yeah. I think with Kickstarter, as you're saying, it's definitely going to be tricky because we had a huge amount of successes in 2012 with Double Fine, Planetary Annihilation, Project Eternity. And, you know, they made millions of dollars, but at the same time, we haven't actually seen those games yet. And I think that's going to be, you know, a big turning point whether or not Kickstarter will continue going if those games will succeed. Because if, you know, developers who are getting millions of dollars can't return that investment, it's going to be a lot harder to get more money out of the consumer afterwards.
I think it's particularly I mean, you've really got two different bands of people in the Kickstarter, the ones that are getting tens of thousands or low hundreds of thousands, and then the ones that are getting millions. And I don't know, I get the sense that those are viewed a little bit differently. I would be surprised if the Kickstarter momentum fades too much personally, but still doesn't mean I want to jump on that bandwagon, but.
one thing that I want to go back to for a second, when you're talking about how when you originally released AI Wars, that was priced at a $20 game, and how you moved to, you know, $5, $7 area. I think this is interesting when you look at basically the indie prices over the last few years. I remember when it was considered, you know, a double A or low budget game would be considered, you know, $30. Indie standard release was, you know, 2025. And, you know, with how things have changed with digital distribution and the increase of sales, everything seems to be trending downwards. Now we have, you know, indie games like Skyward for $5. The game Ruse, I think, just came out for $9, I think, 2 weeks ago. And it's definitely interesting to see, you know, just how much of a change the indie market has had compared to the retail market, which is still, you know, in the $50, $60 range for a new game.
I think that if you look at the PC space, even for AAA games, you know, a lot of those are coming out a little less expensively than they once did and are going on sale frequently enough that the effective purchasing price that a lot of players are getting, if they're a little bit patient and aren't buying day one, is lower than the $60 or $50 you might think of. And so I was reading an article the other day actually about how even in the AAA space, there's kind of a reverse inflation effect going on, and how that's only on the PC though. And so that's potentially something that might cause some problems for the consoles, since those are, you know, they're trying to raise the prices they're selling stuff for there. And, you know, if you look at the Steam subscriber numbers and the Steam active online at any particular time numbers on their little sidebar there, I mean, those just go up and up and up and up and up. And so I think it's a matter of, you know, there was a time when, like, I think Super Nintendo games cost like $70, you know, some of the Squaresoft ones and stuff. And so, you know, we then saw prices fall at some point in there, and, you know, you could get a number of N64 games for, and you could get some of those new for $40, $50, depending on where exactly you got them and exactly when and what the game was. And then, you know, stuff crept back up to $60 when it was, you know, the next gen and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, there's some fluctuations, but at the same time, inflation's been going up, you know, 3% or whatever per year like clockwork, and the price of games has not. Even if you look at the next gen and go, oh, $60, that's so much, which, okay, I agree with that, but at the same time, it's been $60 for a while and has not kept up with inflation. So $60 now is actually a lot less than it was 10 years ago. So in terms of what it really costs you in real dollars. So it's hard to say exactly what all is going on in the market, because there's obviously a lot more than one thing going on. But I think that part of it is just, and, you know, speaking for my own stuff, is there's just so much of a bigger audience. And if you're able to capture that audience, part of capturing that audience is having a price point that's attractive enough for them to jump on the bandwagon and get the ball rolling. And, you know, cause word of mouth is so important and all that. And obviously if you look at like iOS, there's been a race to the bottom with prices to like the 99 cent range. And I'm not sure how I quite feel about that. I don't think that's going to happen with the PC, but I sure do buy a lot of iOS games that I might not otherwise, though. I mean, you know, I probably buy 3 or 4 a month and it costs me all of $4 maybe, you know, and it's like, when I, you know, but I can do that sight unseen based on a good review and say, I want to check this out. Let me see what these indie guys did. Is this neat or not? And if I get 10 minutes out of it and go, that was interesting, cool idea, but I don't want to play anymore, I still don't feel like I've been ripped off for a dollar, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
And I'm a lot of the same way when it comes to PC and just general game sales. My just, you know, buy no matter what price is usually like $5 to $10 in that range. If I see a game that looks interesting and, you know, even if it, I have no idea what it's going to play like, in that range, it's like, who cares? I mean, it's a lot safer to buy games at that price than, you know, spending $30, $40 on a game that's pretty much sight unseen.
Right.
And just talking about the iOS marketplace, I think what's going to happen is with all these price points going lower and lower, it's going to be harder and harder as more independents, you know, move to that space. And because it's hard for them, because how are they going to profit if everything's already just a dollar or free? So either they have to take the risk of going like a little higher, like $2.99, and say that they're a premium service, or they're going to have a really good marketing campaign of some kind or get enough press. You know,
It's interesting though, you already do see some indie games, not all of which have like amazing production values or anything, that are at the $1.99, $2.99, $3.99, occasionally even $4.99 price points, and they do alright. And some of them, you know, the average price on an iPad is actually a lot higher. Like Angry Birds you get for $1 on, you know, the phone, then if you want the iPad version, it's like, I think $4 maybe, $3-$4. And so there's this idea that, okay, it's, you pay a higher price when the screen is up, but then there's all these universal apps that are, they'll work on either one, but they're still a dollar. And so it's really weird because the market's like so schizophrenic there. You get some of the people that are like all mad because they paid a dollar and they didn't like it or whatever, or they're like, $2, this is a ripoff, you know. Then they spend like $3 on something on the iPad. It's just, I don't know. It's just, it's hard to, it's, you know, it's chaos because there's not one group. There's just so many like factions and stuff. And I think that, by definition, you're going to pay a higher price for something that's more niche. And I think that that's all right, because if you are serving a niche, then the price needs to be higher in order for you to turn a profit at all. And the people in that niche are going to be so happy to see you and your game that serves them finally after all this time, you know, that they actually, respond, you know, fine, you know, $20, no problem, here you go. And, with a lot of what we're doing, like at Arkin, we're trying to broaden out a little bit into being a little bit less niche than we are. And I think that Skyward kind of reflects that. It has the depth, but it also is a lot easier to get into than like AI War, where you've got 5 hours of tutorials to go through and you better like losing, sort of thing, which, you know, the people who love that niche, I mean, they love it. But, and you can have really great sales with a niche. I mean, that AI War has grossed over $1 million at this point. So, I mean, niches are there to be served for sure. And people are super happy with, you know, finding games that they just can't get anywhere else, you know, that they want, but that the big companies aren't doing. But then there's also, you know, so there's just, where are you in the market? I mean, and that kind of dictates where your price is. I mean, God Games, if it historically been a little more mainstream, not super mainstream, but a little more so than like super hardcore strategy games anyway.
So are you actually going to bring some of your games to the iOS? Because I was reading a post like earlier that you bought a Unity license for mobile devices.
We did, and we probably will at some point. It's one of those things that's always tricky because you know, with the new market, it's kind of untested for us, and we have, you know, at core, we like making new games, not just porting existing stuff. And there's also the whole thing with sometimes there's a better way to make money than just doing a port, so let's focus on that instead. And hey, it's also what we prefer doing, of making more games. So it's kind of like, well, forget the porting then, because it's like uncertain return and not something we, you know, are going to take much pleasure in doing in the first place. But that said, we really do hope to bring some stuff to iOS. I mean, Skyward would be natural there. Shattered Haven could probably be made to work there. Tidalis would definitely work there, at least on the iPad. And, you know, that's probably about it from our current catalog as far as what would actually work on there. But, you know, I do want to explore other platforms. I'm not sure that I want to be the one actually doing the coding on it. But
well, yeah, actually, two questions to follow up to that. One of them is, what do you think of the Android marketplace? Do you think that's going anywhere? Because that's, you thought iOS is chaotic, that's, Android's even worse.
I really love the idea of Android as a platform, don't get me wrong, but as a developer, as a target platform, there's just nothing attractive about it whatsoever. I mean, the, from other indie developers that I've talked to who published to both iOS and Android, they talk about how, like, almost all of their support requests come from Android, and like less than 10% of their sales come from Android. So it's like, woo, you know, high aftermarket fixed costs there with all these support requests. And the support requests are, of course, coming because of all the different screen aspect ratios, all of the different, you know, processor speeds and other random things that make something compatible or not compatible. I mean, the OSs are such a mess as it is. And there's so many, like, there's a ton of Android devices out there, sure, but there's not a ton of them that are really all that powerful. I mean, there are quite a few really good Android devices, but they're not necessarily what's been being sold in like extreme bulk. So when you look at like, oh, there's however many tens of millions of Android devices or hundreds of millions, whatever it is now, of Android devices, like, well, what percentage of those are the high-powered awesome devices? That's really a little bit harder to say. And since there's not one centralized store even, and some of the stores won't actually, like the Amazon store, I think it is, that has to be like specifically licensed by the device manufacturer in order to be able to be used on that device. So some of the customers get locked out from using the store in question. Maybe it's the Google one. I don't want to spread misinformation.
Yeah, it is the Google one.
The Google one. Okay.
So then you're locked out.
Right. So then all you have is the Amazon one. So I had it backwards, but yeah. So I mean, so then you've got that whole thing. It's just like, all right. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like configurable devices and that's what's up with the PC. I love it. That's our like bread and butter market and you get all sorts of hardware here as well. But the thing is with the PC, there's kind of a baseline level of hardware that you know is going to be there in any sort of modern thing. You can set, okay, these are the minimum screen resolution parameters that are going to be there. You can say, you know, we are going to assume that pretty well anybody has a 1.6 gigahertz processor and, you know, blah, 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 some other things. And so because those are high enough specs, in other words, anybody who's really looking for games on Steam probably already meets the minimum specs of what we're looking for. And because we can post the specs, and anybody who's trying to buy a game for the PC is going to understand, do I meet those specs or not? That's all fairly straightforward. In 4 years, I really don't think I've ever had somebody go, I bought this and I can't play it on my PC because the specs are too low. I mean, I did have some people that bought something and they're like, I thought for a laugh I'd see if it would run on my netbook. And hey, it does. You can't see the bottom of the menu because this thing's only like 480 pixels tall. But aside from that one bit, and I can kind of feel around for the menu, it actually works. I was so surprised. And I'm like, all right, wow. But you know, that was kind of their choice and kind of a, let's see what I can do sort of thing, not a, this is all I have and oh man, I'm toasted now. What a waste of money. And the Android market, that's just, it's not the case. The people who have the worst phones in terms of specs are probably also not the most savvy of the ones. So they're like, I want to download Angry Birds and I expect it to work. You know, I want to, you know, I hit the button, it comes up, that's it. That should be the experience as far as they're concerned. But because of the nature of the market and the nature of their phone, that may very well not be the case. Obviously with Angry Birds, it is because those guys have like $1 billion to make sure that that's the case. But you know, for anybody else, I mean, can you spend the money to buy like, you know, 100 flavors of Android phone and test on all of them?
I mean, you're pretty much taking the arguments of, you know, Tether versus open devices. Pretty much why people like developing on consoles versus PC, you know, because you know what you're going to get with the PC, but you don't know what you're going to get when it comes to computers. But as you said, you're right. You're making an average of like 1.6 gigahertz. That makes sense. But I think it's way more relevant now to the phones. You're right. iOS versus Android.
I think that what's going to happen is that the Android marketplace is going to become attractive. It's going to take a while. I don't know exactly when it's going to be, but let's just say 10 years from now.
It's a long time.
It's a long time, but it's long enough that we can say, all right, well, if you look back 10 years to, you know, 2003, the average speed of, you know, laptops and PCs that were sold to the average consumer, I mean, gigahertz wise, they weren't a whole lot less, but that's misleading because of all the architectural type stuff, and they didn't have multiple cores, and, you know, the RAM in them, you know, you're probably doing pretty good with 1 gig of RAM and, you know, so forth and so on. So that was 10 years ago. If you look forward, another 10 years, then, it's really not something that is, the minimum spec is going to be so high that for most developers, fine, you're not going to you don't necessarily have to test on every piece of hardware, because you can pretty much guess that anything that was made in the last 3-4 years, 10 years from now, will be good enough to run your game, unless your game is really pushing the envelope hardware wise. And that's a long time from now. It'll probably happen sooner than that, but it's, you know, it's not 2 or 3 years out. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting, especially because, like we talk about iOS and Android, one being tethered and one being not, but Microsoft 8 is going to, at least for developers, make it a lot tougher, because you have to go through anything you develop on it has to go through like a center before you have to get, so any software you develop has to be approved, or that's their end goal, which is pretty scary if you think about it. So in 10 years, I wonder what's going to happen with both OSs being tethered.
It's really only, you know, the Windows 8, if you're talking about the phone, then yeah, but on the PC, I mean, that's only if you want to sell through their store. I mean, you know, and we have a lot of customers on Windows 8 that, they use our stuff just like anything else. They either install it directly from us and Windows 8 like freaks out and acts like this is like some terrible piece of malware, you know, because oh my God, it doesn't necessarily have all the security certificates or whatever they want, but the people are like, yeah, fine, it's Arkin, here we go, blah, 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 and it's on. Or they download it through Steam and like any other game, it plays on Windows 8, that's it. So, you know, it would be a pretty big foot shooting for Microsoft to try and close the PC. I just, their big customers are, you know, business among other things, and trying to close the door like that on business, that's just not gonna happen, so.
Well, I think that might just take the risk and see what happens. Like, well, what happens if we shut out all these, like, people that like to do configurations and such? And focus on the average, which is like what Apple did and was successful. So yeah,
But Apple was trying to pick up a niche, whereas Microsoft is trying to retain the majority. So, you know, Microsoft has so much momentum that there's a real reluctance for change in general there. So obviously Windows 8 is an exception to that.
It's gonna be the Vista of the future. Or we're gonna look back at it and we're like, oh, Vista, ME. 8.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on and talk a little bit about Skyward Collapse, because this is just one of like the most interesting games I've seen in a while, both from the strategy genre and just from your own studio. So I guess my first question is, where did the inspiration come from for Skyward's design?
Well, not one real place. I mean, I guess the original germ of the idea was, if you play the game Carcassonne, it's a board game. Yeah, so I mean, I really like that game. It's one where, you know, you place tiles and, you know, you've built up cities and farmland and, you know, all this other sort of stuff. And, you know, you place your little guys down and it's cool. You get this nice little landscape and you're like, wow, that looks really cool. And it's a fun game. And I've played that for years. And, what I kind of was like thinking was, well, what if we made something, you know, vaguely like Carcassonne in the sense that it's tile placement, but the tiles, you know, had living people on it. And, you know, once you placed them down, stuff happened and you couldn't really control it, but you were controlling it by where you put the tiles. And that was originally the idea. And originally we thought it was going to be kind of a random tile drawing thing. So you can't choose what tiles you put wherever and you don't have like resources. It would just be, you know, you draw a tile from kind of a virtual bag, or at one point we had it like you draw a set of tiles kind of like in Scrabble. So you'd have like 7 that would come out of the bag and you could choose one that you could put down and then the others would go back in the bag, or you know, some various rules that we had on that. And, you know, that felt too random. That was too kind of traditional board game in a lot of ways, and you just didn't really have any enough control. And so it went through various iterations, and it really came out as a God game, which sort of was kind of an inspiration, but we kind of backed in to that door. We didn't really set out to make a god game per se, although we were putting you in the role of a godly overseer the whole time, but I just mean in terms of the genre, you know. So, I mean, the thematically it was always, you know, gods and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, we just kind of wanted to make a thing where you would create this landscape and it was have highly strategic kind of solitaire aspects to it. And an indirection of control and you kind of seeing the living landscape around there and, you know, making it turn-based as well. And that was what we started with. And then it was a matter of prototyping and seeing what felt fun. And once we got through a number of prototypes and discovered what really was fun, then we sat down and made a fuller design document and said, all right, this is what we're doing. And we plowed through there. And then there was more iterations and stuff during our alpha with our players. You know, it was pretty fun in early alpha, but it really, through the month of alpha, that's when it really started to shine with the help of our players. And they were like, this was an interesting idea with a lot of promise at the start of alpha. And now it's like really fun. It's like, yes, you know, so, you know, we have a huge thanks to our players for that.
Now, one thing that is interesting about Skyrim is the fact that you're effectively playing against yourself as you're controlling both sides. Was that part of the original concept, or did that come about during the alpha?
That was definitely one of the original things. I mean, that whole kind of solitaire aspect, we really wanted it. I like being the dungeon master when I play, you know, role-playing games of whatever sort, or, you know, board games that have a dungeon mastery type role. And my game, when I'm doing that, the way that I keep myself entertained and why I like being the dungeon master is that I try to see how close I can push the players to the brink of failing and then watch if they'll topple over. You know, I'll never like actually make them lose, but I will make it, you know, so that if they make a mistake or two that they'll make themselves lose. And that's kind of what I like doing. And I wanted to have one of my core things going into this was saying, I want to have an impetus to do this to myself, not for extrinsic, reasons of just, I like doing that sort of thing, but because the rules of the game kind of require me to do that to win. So it's just that kind of bring me the whip and switch boy sort of feeling where it's like, you did it to yourself. And, so yeah, that was one of the fundamental things.
Mm-hmm. Did the aspect of like the whole mythological units, different cultures, was that part of the original design as well, having, you know, the Greek and the Norse, or they added in as well during the alpha?
That was something that by the time we started doing any implementation at all, we knew what it was going to be. I mean, we went through a lot of different themes trying to figure out something that would be suitably robust in terms of clarity, but also not just generic and something that people have done like a million times. And the, you might actually laugh at that a little bit since Norse and Greek have been seen in a lot of games, but we went with a really different part of their mythology, and there's a lot of things, you know, the Norse mythology in general is just insane. It's huge. There's all this crazy stuff that happened in their mythology and just all this stuff that's off the beaten track. Yeah, everybody knows like Thor and Odin and, maybe there's another guy. I don't know, but there's like 40 plus gods and stuff and just all these crazy, just, you know, history of like the frost giants and all these different things and the nine worlds that are, you know, linked by the world tree and just all this stuff. It's crazy. And, you know, with the Greek stuff too, there's a lot more familiarity with that that people have, but there's still a lot of, kind of secondary stuff that people are less familiar with, a lot of secondary myths and so on and so forth. And, so we took those two mythologies in particular because they're really deep and they have a lot of aspects that are unfamiliar to a lot of people. And we considered all sorts of themes before that, though, before we knew we were going to have gods as an element, before we started implementing it all. And it was like, you know, we considered like just straight doing medieval, but thought that was really boring. And we thought about doing you know, I was really in favor of doing dinosaurs at one point, like carnivores versus herbivores, but it was kind of decided that might be a little bit cheesy, as well as being something that would be a little bit hard to visualize for players if they don't really understand, like, all right, well, the different types of carnivores and what their roles are in the army or whatever. And, you know, we thought about doing like Western or something. And it's like, well, it's kind of cowboys versus cowboys unless we suddenly go really racist with it. It's like, that's not good. So it's just like Civil War is boring and been done a bunch. Like Napoleonic Wars, those are kind of interesting. They've been done to death. And a lot of those other sort of scenarios are like things that just the really hardcore, like, super involved turn-based strategy games use. And so anyway, that's how we wound up there. We went all over the place and then had settled on that.
So you talk about some myths, you know, a lot of people know. What was the most interesting one that you found that you thought was cool when you were doing your research?
There's a lot of them. I guess one of my favorite ones, and I should add that, Josh Knapp, who was my co-designer on this, and he did all the historical research and then came back with all these cool things, and then together we figured out how to integrate them into the game. So it was really cool how much stuff he was able to distill down and get at really unusual myths and so on. But at any rate, one of the cool ones was Heimdall and his horn on the north side. And Heimdall is a god that is responsible for watching for the coming of Ragnarok, which is like Armageddon. And when that's coming, he's going to blow his horn, you know, to let all the other gods and everybody know, here it comes. And I'm not really sure what the point of that is. It's still going to happen, but whatever. At least they know.
They have a couple seconds to like put their pants on.
Yeah, exactly. So that was pretty cool because we were like, all right, well, let's, you know, we're going to have Heimdall in the game. Let's put his horn in too. So we made it so that his horn like literally causes Armageddon. And it makes everybody who's standing outside, who's not a god and who's not like in a building, just drops dead. And it was like, that was really cool because it was one of those things that was really interesting, mythologically speaking, and that we were able to translate into something really clear and really clearly connected in terms of, the gameplay mechanic and the mythological stuff. And there's a bunch of other ones too. I mean, like the Midgard serpent is really interesting. This giant snake that holds the world together, but also causes some other troubles. And, you know, the world tree itself is pretty interesting because it's Yggdrasil. It, you know, connects the nine worlds and there you get some things going back and forth between them. And, you know, you got some of the somewhat known gods, like Pan on the Greek side or, Loki on the north side and how like mischievous they are and stuff. And there's some fun things that you can do with those and specifically some funny myths that go along with them. But yeah.
And, talking about balance, that's definitely an interesting discussion with Skyward because the game really, from playing it, it's balanced on the fact that it's not balanced at all. You got all this just insanity going on. Like when you have one of the Greeks, myth tokens, I think it's adamantine, that like gives them like 100 times attack and defense power. And it's just like hilarious watching you run around doing like 60,000 points of damage.
Mm-hmm.
So like what was like the design process for, I guess, trying to balance something that is so imbalanced?
The part of that bring me the whipping switch boy, your own worst enemy sort of thing comes about by putting the player in the role of being the one that brings the balance. So like normally with a strategy game, I mean like AI War for instance, if there's some sort of thing that's clearly more powerful than everything else, then that's a really, you know, bad thing, capital B, capital T, because, you know, everybody then starts using that and the game loses all interest and it's like, that's the one strategy and you win. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everything has to be in some sort of semblance of balance where there's no one clear best strategy. And with Skyward, the goal is the opposite. You don't want to win in the sense of how you want to win in AI War. You want your side to win in AI War. So if there's something that furthers your goal too much, more than anything else furthers that goal, then that's an exploit and that's a problem. Whereas in Skyward, the very premise of it is that you don't want to win in terms of either side. Mm-hmm. You don't have a side. And so anything that is too powerful is actually more of a problem for you, the player, than us, the developer. And in our case, we had to balance things, or rather unbalance things, in a way that they were fun and not actually in a numeric sort of sense. And so to that end, making it so that, you know, the Norse are down and you're like, oh God, I got to help the Norse. And so you're like, what are my options? And it's like, you've got some things that are clearly not powerful enough. And then this one thing that's like completely OP and you're like, oh, you know, I'm either going to die by not playing this stuff thing that's OP, or, all right, fine, I played the thing that's OP, and now the Norse are just ripping it up, and you're like, the Greeks, you know, I need to, now what do I do for the Greeks? And you're like, all right, I play Adamantine, and it's like, oh my God, somebody kill that guy now, and it's just like the back and forth, because you can never quite get that thing back. The hair of a needle there. And so on the point of a needle. And so it's just, you know, there were some points during the alpha where we were like, the Norse and the Greek are really having too much of an easy time. Let's really weaken the Norse military. And they were like, well, that's better, but the Norse aren't getting their butts kicked enough. We're like, let's drop them some more. And so it's like, yeah, all right, that feels about right. Later, it's just, it was pretty funny.
Going back to what you were saying about designing the game around being fun instead of being, you know, numerical balance, I remember during the first week about the Minotaur design and how you guys changed that to make it a little less powerful. And for those who haven't played it, in the original version, the Minotaur's basic attack was a fireball that would basically hit, like, I think it was like a cross design, that was his attack pattern, or I think three tiles.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that thing would just, like, you put it next to a town and it would wipe the town out in like two turns. And I think one of the things you said was that it was fun, it was in balance, but it wasn't fun in balance. Could you elaborate a little bit on that kind of design thinking for Skyward?
In terms of the Minotaur in particular, it was a little bit thematically out of balance, mm-hmm. in the sense of, generally speaking, I mean, for one thing, players understand stuff better if it's done in groups. So the general rule is the Norse mythologicals are all, on average, stronger than the Greek ones. And the Greek military, you know, phalanxes and all that good stuff, those guys, you know, kick the butt of the Norse military. And so as a general rule, that's the thing. When it came to, like, the Minotaurs, those guys on the Greek side actually would just kind of roll over some of the Norse stuff. So that was counterintuitive if you were knowing that the Greek stuff was normally supposed to be weaker mythologically, but then what's Minotaur? What are you doing? You know, and it also was one of those things that it was a little too easy to shoot yourself in the foot with, because you don't really want a Minotaur near any town if he's just accidentally leveling like half of it per turn. And so that is something that it wasn't exactly creating a situation where it made the game too easy or anything like that. We didn't have to make that change because it was like broken, let's say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, unlike a balance change for AI War where we tweak that because otherwise it gets exploitive. Mm-hmm. But we really had to make that sort of change because it's just not fun. If you act, you know, you put down a Minotaur to do something and then extra collateral damage is good, but the scale of the extra collateral damage that this guy was causing was like way out of proportion with what was actually fun. Mm-hmm. Cause it's like, there's a difference between bring me the whip and switch boy and saw your leg off boy. You know, there's, there's a line there somewhere. Yeah. You know, and players let you know where it is too. Mm-hmm. So
now another part of, you know, this crazy design of Skyward are the woes. And you got a huge variety of them in there. There's, you know, like little ones, like, you know, you run out of food, to like the big ones, you know, oh, the land just got completely destroyed and covered in obsidian. Were there any woes like that you were coming up with that were either too imbalanced, or how did you go about balancing out, you know, these game-changing events?
There were a couple that we had to change because the feedback from players was that they just weren't fun. For the most part, the most the biggest purpose of the woes is to keep shifting the balance in ways that you can't predict, so that you have to be reactive. Because if you don't have an exterior force like that working against you, you know, there's no opponent in this. So if just left to your own devices and you can do everything and there's no external stimuli, you'll figure out essentially like a mathematical equation for how to play, mm-hmm. and that's it. You're done. It's no longer any fun. It's fun until you figure out that formula. So there has to be kind of that, you know, noise coming from some other source other than yourself. And so the bandits cause some of that. Then usually the most interesting situations are things that have the procedural generation designs are ones that have multiple layers. So woes were another layer that add, you know, combining with bandits and combining with the other game mechanics with things being intentionally out of balance to begin with. Those just really swirl the pot and make it so that you can't predict what's going on. So in terms of making sure that those are balanced, that wasn't really necessarily a concern. We thought up, you know, how many different things can we think of? And then, all right, about how difficult do we gauge that is? All right, so we're gonna clamp that to these difficulties, and we're gonna make this so that can only happen in these rounds, and so on. And there were a few complaints that we get from players here and there, every so often about this one's really kind of outside the bounds of fun, and here's why. And we'd look at that and we go, okay, you know, that makes sense. So we're gonna change it in these ways, and then boom, there we go. And so it's really much more of a relaxed process with the balance there. It's not an easy process for keeping the factions feeling unique and figuring out how to keep players from cheesing certain strategies. That's where the trickiness comes in, with the design of this game. But with things like the woes, as long as you aren't being like ridiculous in terms of way too difficult. Mm-hmm. If something's a little bit too easy, that's actually okay, because they only come by periodically anyway, and everybody loves a brief respite. So if there's something that's like, oh, phew, flood, and that was an easy one for the moment because there weren't any lakes threatening me, it's like, okay, phew, I have a little more time to work before whatever's coming next mm-hmm. comes, you know. So it's like, you know, nobody's going to complain about that. But if it's just like flood, 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 and they never do anything, then, well, that's obviously a problem. So it's a matter of just having kind of a good range and nothing being too much of an outlier of, like, way too unfun hard.
Another question I have regarding game balance is with the regular human units.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for a game that's so unique like Skyward, where you're not controlling them directly, how did you go about designing the various units for each side, you know, balancing them, you know, between their different classes and such?
That was actually fairly traditional. I don't have a super interesting answer for that. The siege units in general were something that we wanted to have be fairly unique, and, you know, because they have a pretty important role with punching into towns and the bandit keeps and all that. With the regular units, there again, we wanted to have them be asymmetrical enough that there would be a lot of interest there. And you might even notice that there's a pikeman unit on the Greek side. Nobody's ever actually commented on this before, but there's a pikeman unit on the Greek side, and the Norse have like next to no horses. So what is that pikeman there for? He's got a bonus against cavalry. Well, that pikeman is there because you can play Greek versus Greek. And if you do that, then suddenly your pikemen are causing problems for like your podromos and so forth that are cavalry. And so, they're even balanced against themselves in some ways, where, you run into some kind of funky asymmetries with the same faction against itself, in ways that you might not when you're playing one faction against the other. And, you know, just making sure that we had enough of variety and enough niches there, and then, making it so that the resource costs were appropriate. That was probably one of the more tricky things, and making it so that it was desirable to have all the different types where you wouldn't just stick with the most basic one. That also was tricky. But again, it's pretty much in line with how we would balance something like AI War. Cause when you're balancing units like that against one another, side versus side, we didn't have to worry. But again, one unit versus another, making sure that none are irrelevant, that was something that was pretty traditional.
One question that I have, just for my own curiosity, I know in the game that the actual AI controls what units are built from each building. Does the game look at basically, I guess what's on the field when deciding what units to build, or is it just like RAM that just picks from available resources and decides what you need to build on that regard?
You missed that in the tutorial. That's actually incredibly predictable. Mm-hmm. It has a loop. And so, if you look in the barracks or whatever, it says, you know, here's the next thing that's going to be built. Mm-hmm. And then it goes down to the next item in the list and keeps looping through.
Okay.
And so it'll just build things, assuming that you have all the resources for everything, it'll just keep building things in a loop.
Okay.
The purpose of the finished goods is so you can control that indirectly. So you can say, I only want to build these particular military units in this particular town, so I'm only going to give them access to these resources, therefore they can't build the other stuff they don't have resources for, okay. And therefore you're able to field a very specific sort of army from specific sorts of specific towns. And that's something that means that you actually can set what is being built at each, at least at each town, not at a specific barracks within a town, but you can very finely control what's coming out of there. And that's actually one of the interesting things once you get into the harder core strategy of it, you know, cause it's not even something you need to know to play it kind of casually. But if you're like trying to play on the top difficulties, that's something you need to know and can, you know, actually think about as you're going.
Yeah, it definitely gets crazy when you get to the higher difficulty levels when characters start leveling up, bandits can go through mountains, and then just like the crazier woes that start hitting you.
Oh yeah, some of those woes had to be withheld for a reason to higher difficulties.
Alright, so let's move on and talk a little bit about what's going to be in the future for Skyward. Because one of my nitpicks I had with the game was the fact that, as you said, it was built for, you know, only a few hours of actual content, and then if the game would have taken off, you guys were going to start building up into, you know, the same epic levels of AI wars. So I was looking at the forums our last few days about the design posts, and it looks like you got a lot of interesting ideas. So what's, I guess, the big one that you're excited about is going to be coming with Skyward? I think you said you have expansion planned for next month?
Probably for August, okay. In terms of actually coming out. We'll probably start the beta next month and then just let it simmer for a month and, you know, get design feedback and all that sort of stuff, balance feedback. Mm-hmm. One thing I will say real quick is that I think you may underestimate the amount of replay value in there at the moment. And we've got people that have put in, you know, 50 plus hours on there. It really depends on how into it you are and on what level you're playing it at. If you're playing at a moderate difficulty level, I agree you can kind of plateau, you know, after some number of hours, 4 or 5 hours, 6, some, I don't know. It really depends on what exactly you're doing. You know, how into it are you? I mean, you can plateau in any game after a couple of hours if you're just not that into it. But, you know, at the upper end, you can really push forward a lot. Now, obviously one of the things that I want to do with post-release content in the first expansion is really focus on expanding out the longevity of it on the middle difficulties. So you don't have to play on, like, you know, the knock your teeth out difficulties to really have dozens of hours out of it or something. You don't have to be on the hardcore end of the spectrum, in other words. And so to that end, we're working on two things at the moment. One is the first expansion, as you noted, and the other one is a version 2.0 of Skyward, which will release alongside of that. And so there's a bunch of new stuff in both of them. Let me talk about 2.0 first, actually, because I think that's the free update.
Okay.
And so one of the things that has been, I think, the biggest criticism that I would definitely agree with is that the third age, the age of gods, so this, you know, the three ages, as you know, but listeners might not, with the age of man, age of monsters, age of gods. With the third age, you know, you get the greater gods that come out, but that's kind of about it. There's not a really huge shift. Whereas at the start of the second age, you start getting a lot more, you start getting like bandit monsters and you start getting, you know, gods at all. Mm-hmm. And, you also start getting, you get a catastrophic woe right at the start of, that second age. So a lot of things change all of a sudden at the start of the second age. And that's not really true in the third age. Mm-hmm. And, so to that end, we're focusing on introducing some new mechanics around having heroes and villains that pop out in the third age, along with the gods. And so basically, roll a random fantastical, you know, fictional villain that is kind of making life difficult for you and your folks and is yet another sort of source of imbalance. Mm-hmm. And then one of your factions will spout some hero. And so those heroes are faction specific. So like on the Greek, you've got Atalanta. On the Norse, you've got like Beowulf, and there's two for each. And for the Japanese, which are coming up in the next expansion, you've got like Oda Nobunaga and some of the others. I just butchered that. I do know how to say it, but at any rate, so then you've got the heroes that are kind of fighting. The villains have a castle, and you have to kind of get your heroes over there to get them to destroy it, and some other things like that. There's still a lot of specifics that we're working through on the design as we nail stuff down, so I don't want to go into too much detail because it'll probably be changed by the time we get another month or two in. But at any rate, making the third age a lot more distinctive and having yet another source of things that you have to do in order to keep things in balance is, without it becoming like overwhelming where it's like you're trying to juggle 10 eggs or something, you know. I think that by the time people are hitting the Age of Gods, they're ready for a little bit more to go on. So having kind of another subsystem that's limited enough in complexity, but still interesting enough is what we're aiming at there. We're also, as part of the 2.0 update, adding in complete new units for the bandits. So the bandits have their own unique units. Mm-hmm. So, they won't be using by default, when they're spawning their own stuff, the mythologicals or their human units from the Norse and the Greeks and so on anymore, they'll have their own. And so, that gives another source of imbalance, and it also lets us, specifically tailor the units from the bandits to counter some of the cheesier, player strategies. So if, you know, the players are able to abuse the mountains and the lakes a little bit, providing a little bit too good of protection, unless you play on the higher difficulties where the bandits have bloodlust and just go over the mountains. Mm-hmm. Well, even on the lower difficulties, we'd like that to be a little bit less cheesy. And so they've got, like a siege drill, that can just kind of burrow through the mountains. And so you want to either take care of those or build multiple rings of mountains. Mm-hmm. So rather than just saying you can't build mountains, or we make somehow or other nerf that strategy into just not existing at all, it actually becomes something that is a valid strategy. You don't have to put mountains out there, but if you do, you have to worry about the siege drills. Mm-hmm. If you do, then you may want to put multiple rings of mountains, and then you've got this whole other, you know, mm-hmm. dynamic going on with, all right, that mountain blocking thing is no longer kind of a cheesy exploit. It's actually one of many valid strategies. So I'm pretty pleased with how we turned that on its head. And so there's a number of things like that that we're doing in the 2.0 version. And, with the mythologicals, right now in the base game, there are 8 mythological creatures in total. There's 4 each from the Norse and the Greek. For the 2.0 version, we're adding 10 new mythologicals in all that are just for the bandits. And those are staggered so that some are just for the Age of Monsters, some are just for the Age of Gods, and some are for both. So you start seeing these progression of further crazy monster things coming at you out of the bandit keeps once you reach the Age of Gods, so that there's yet more, you know, more of a feeling of progression as you go, which is good. So those are the things that we're looking at for the base game. There's a few other things that we're looking at too, like soul collection and and adjusting some of the how the trading works in particular, because I felt like that was kind of underwhelming. And then also looking at some other few tweaks and stuff, and obviously adding more woes and some things like that, because more is always better. and so that's what we're doing for the base game, which obviously comes at no cost to anybody who already has the game, and I'm really excited about that stuff. So for the expansion that's coming, that's going to center on two main things. One, adding a third faction, which is the Japanese. And we're doing some really different things with the Japanese, where they just work really differently from the other two factions. They only get, normally for all of your archery range, barracks, and siege workshops, you get 4 units there once you've unlocked them all, and they come out in cycle. With the Japanese, they're only going to have 3. They don't have 4. So it's fewer human guys to choose from. But on the mythological unit side, they're having, I think it's 8, whereas normally the other factions only have 4. So you actually have a lot more direct control with the Japanese of things that you can just plop down for a specialized purpose. And they'll probably wind up being a little bit cheaper to place and a little more effective as well. And then the gods are where things get really crazy with the Japanese, because normally with the Greeks and the Norse, you've got the gods that appear and then they just stand there. And then you have tokens that are 3 tokens per god, and you can say, here's, I put down this token, now that god moves the token and takes some sort of like crazy action. And of course the gods have a passive bonus while they're standing there, like, you know, staring down your guys, that they're changing things on that side. Well, with the Japanese, they're not going to have any god tokens whatsoever. So you can't give any orders to the Japanese gods. You can't tell them, like, do this thing. But they also don't just stand there. Instead of standing there, they'll kind of wander around slowly, like, smiting dudes as you go. And so they're this other source of kind of chaos. And then instead of having the tokens, each individual Japanese god out of the 8 that there are will have 3 mythological units that are specific to them. These are various demigods or mythological creatures and so forth, that are specific from the Japanese mythologies. And they'll spawn these, units as they move around, creating some new chaos that is really specific to that god. So the Japanese are kind of a funny mix, because you have both extra control and way less control. You have extra control in terms of the mythological placement. You have way less control in terms of the gods. But then the gods are like really powerful, but maybe not in the way that you want. And so they're really different from either of the other two factions, which I'm generally pleased about. I think they'll be very interesting for players who've gotten used to the Greek and the Norse in particular.
Cool. All right. I just have a few more questions.
And then we also do have civilian hamlets, and that's another really big thing, but I don't think we want to get into that whole thing. But that's the other 2 big anchor features anyway for the expansion, but those are the 2. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
That's all right. Yeah, the civilian stuff from your forum post definitely sounds going to be interesting. That's going to possibly be figure like other like side goals, I think, from what I read.
Possibly other what now?
Like side ways to win or side things.
Yes. Yes. So those will basically civilian hamlets will pop up in the towns where towns of yours used to be that they died. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of manage the buildings there, and there's all this kind of squabbling back and forth between the peasants and the nobles and other things. And there's kind of a bunch of kind of like the RCI bars in SimCity, but little bars per building that you have to kind of manage to make sure the stuff all keeps in balance. It's this whole new kind of little closed ecosystem that you're dealing with on a per hamlet basis. And you can use those to generate some benefits for your main game, or you can use those to get to one of 2 different secondary victory conditions.
Sounds cool. So I guess in terms of overall balance, you were talking about how you're going to be enhancing the Age of Gods phase of the game. Will there be, like, in the future any more, like, upsets to the first or second age of the game, or will they be basically, like, left alone from this point on?
Well, in terms of, we're not really adjusting the balance per se, it's just adding some more interesting things into the Age of Gods. And I think that the first 2 ages are pretty satisfying in terms of the core game, in terms of what they are. And I think you risk overwhelming players if you throw too much at them too fast, which for an experienced player anyway, there's enough going on in the first 2 ages. There's not really a need. There's not really a need for more. And with like chess or something, you have a distinct, flow between the beginning, middle, and end game. And the problem with what's going on right now is that the end game is unique, but not unique enough. Or at least not as unique as we wanted it to be. And so while it's fun, it could be more fun. So, you know, here we go. And with the first 2 ages, through expansions and so forth, those are where we kind of have an unbridled ability to do more complexity without overwhelming a new player because, hey, you're buying an expansion because you want more complexity. You've mastered what's there and you want some more stuff. So, you know, yeah, we're going to be putting more stuff into all three of the ages in those. And like the Hamlets, for instance, that increases potential complexity on all three of the ages, depending on when exactly you start having towns getting raised. In terms of, woes and so on, those add more variety. You know, there will always be more variety in every age, but in terms of complexity, where do we need it? And it's kind of on a case by case basis. And,
Yeah. I guess I just have two more questions. The first one is regarding the metagame. I know when you were here last time, you talked about how there were going to be challenges, and then that sort of got phased into the profile leveling system. And I know that on the forum you talk about how there's definitely like mixed opinions. Some people like having the metagame, others just want everything, you know, unlocked from the get-go. With future content, will that be fed into the metagame, or will that sort of be left as it is from the original release?
That's a good question, and I don't have a definitive answer for that. For now, most likely, with the Japanese in particular and all that stuff, that will probably be available from the get-go. I kind of think if somebody buys an expansion, they're kind of expecting to get that content right now versus having to work through. And there is a cheat code that you can use to unlock all the content if you don't like the metagame, you know. The cheat code doesn't impact your ability to get, you know, achievements or anything like that. But the metagame in general with that was one way to kind of drip feed extra complexity so we could do stuff that's more complex, but you're not necessarily seeing it your first game. And the game tells you, all right, this is what you can just ignore for now. You don't have to worry about, you know, diplomacy or trade or some of the other crazier buildings just yet. You know, we're going to lock these. Don't even worry about it. Look at this other stuff, you know. This stuff's blacked out. You don't have to think about it. And then, you know, as you're hitting the point where you want more stuff, then you're finding it. Or if you want it immediately, you do the cheat code and you just play. But in terms of an expansion, you know, I think it's fun to have more metagame content for the players who like that sort of thing. But I just don't know how that fits in an expansion because there's not a guarantee that, you know, once we have multiple expansions, somebody's going to buy them in order. So what happens if they buy the second expansion before they buy the first one? I don't really know how that would work in terms of the profile unlocks, you know what I mean? So it gets really challenging there. So most likely we won't be doing a bunch of more metagame stuff than's already there, but you never know.
Yeah. All right. I think we'll wrap it up here then, because we are about an hour and 20 in now. So, Ken, do you have any questions you want to ask Chris?
No, but you really sold me well on this game. I'm really excited to pick it up.
Yeah, well, thanks.
All right. In that case, we're going to end here for the Perceptive Podcast this week. I would like to thank Ken and Chris for being on.
Yep.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's always great talking to you, and we definitely can't wait to see how Skyward is going to be developed over the next few months and even over the course of the year. Sounds like it's going to be a very interesting game for what's going to transform into and what you're going to be adding to it.
Hopefully we're at it for a long time. We're 4 years and counting on AI War, so... We'll see.
It'll be crazy to like look back at, you know, the reviews for the game in a year or 2 years and see all the craziness you guys have added in.
AI War, I'm telling you, it's already there. You look back at the reviews from 2009 and it's like, wow.
All right. And as always, for those of you listening, if you are interested in either writing a piece for the site or being a future guest on the cast, you can send us an email from the front page. Just click on Submissions Wanted, and we are always happy to hear from you. And with that, we're going to end it here. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.